What is the outlook for Russia, Ukraine, and for China? Plus, what is going on in the markets?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, we do have the second half of our interview today with Matt Gerken of BCA Research. He is their geopolitical expert. Last week, if you missed it, you can go back to our website or our podcast, and you can catch the first half of the interview where he talks about what's going on with Doge and Iran, which we're very interested in what's going on with Iran. Today, we follow up with what's going on in Russia, Ukraine, which he mentions it's happening fast over there.
Yep.
What's going on with China, especially in the long term. So it's a very good interview. Highly recommend if you missed the first half, you go catch that. All right, Jerry. What else do we want to talk about today? There's stuff going on in the markets this week.
There is. Bottom line is what, just kind of giving people an update. I'm working on a new special report. Now, I went back and kind of looked at the special report from last September, and even though you'd had to say the conclusion of what I thought we were going to go into turned out to be wrong, and that's one of those, okay, how often do you hear somebody on radio say they were wrong? Well, I don't know. I'm volunteering. I raised my hand on this, and I remember saying that. One of our shows, I said, February, I might be saying I'm wrong. Who knows?
Right.
Well, it's February, and I'm wrong. But the issue is, it's a crazy deal. I'm looking at the cover of the Election Blues. I'm writing a new special report as we speak. Hopefully, it will be out and finished sometime next week. But I'm sitting here looking at the front page, and the front page had a chart from Bank Credit Analyst, and the title is, The Unemployment Rate Keeps Going Up Once It Starts Rising. And we know, historically speaking, once it passed a certain threshold where you bottom out on the unemployment rate, then you start rising. Once it passes a certain threshold, then you've had 11 times that's happened previous in history going back to World War II, and 11 times you've had a recession. 11 out of 11 times. Can you say anomaly? Can you say exception? I would say probably Trump.
Right, because you're saying the 12th time it didn't happen.
It did not happen, and it's shocking. I'm looking at something from Strategus that said, longest contraction on record for the leading index of economic indicators after 26 months. And that's really, this is the exception to the rule. Things like that happen in life. It's hard to predict them. It's hard to plan on them. As a matter of fact, in the new special report, I've got an article, I've got a chart that I'll be putting in there, which is from Ned Davis. Now, their methodology is somewhat different than the conference board that puts out the leading index of economic indicators. They won't tell us the secret sauce. But Ned Davis has been more accurate on this than any of the other analysts. Alpine Macro has been pretty good, too. Bank Credit Analysts they fell on their face last year, and I should have not listened to them, bottom line. But that's the way the world works in our industry. So the issue here is the Ned Davis has a different chart that we're putting in this one, and it's the same thing. I think it's 11, without counting on the chart in front of me right now, 11 times since World War II, the indicators hit this level, and I'll show it clearly on the special report, 11 times you had a recession after that. The 12th one is a false signal.
Right.
So the bottom line is, weird things happen in history, and how do you count that?
It's hard to go against those, right?
And
we know nothing's guaranteed.
Not right.
In this industry. But it's hard to go against something that's worked 11 out of 11 times.
For 50 years, over 50
yeah.
years, 60 years. So 60 years, every time XYZ has happened, it's produced a recession. This time it didn't. And I can only say, I don't believe in excuses. Those of you listening to our show long term know that. But I think without Trump, we would have gone in the toilet. I really think that's happened. And I think him turning the whole thing around, winning with such a strong, even though he's got thin margins in the House and thin margins in the Senate, comparatively, but he won so many states. It was so decisive of a victory against the liberal New World Order left wing. It's just it's an amazing turnaround, and I think in history, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, we'll look back and say this was a historic election. It turned the ship in more ways than one. And I'm not even talking about, you know, I mean, it's we were talking, I think it was you or David was talking about Strategus. It's a great service. And they had their geopolitical guy on there, and they were doing their live call mm-hmm. that they did every week. And he said, by the way, if this changes while I'm doing the call, come tell me. Don't let me just keep rambling about something that just changed, because it's, the changes are happening so fast nobody can keep up with them all. And that's a good thing from the standpoint of the left. They don't know what hit them. Like, okay, where do we plug the hole? Okay, let's put our finger in the dike here. No, it's over here. No, it's over here. No, or whack-a-mole. You know, boom, 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 whack-a-mole. Anyways, so this truly, in my opinion, is a historic election, number one. Number two, as you and I talked about before the show, we've talked so many times about the fourth turning over the last, well, since 2008. Number four, if you're not familiar with this or if you're new to our show, a book called The Fourth Turning. I've read portions of the new book, which is The Fourth Turning is Here. Frankly, I still like the original book that was written in 1997 better. And the stuff that is happening today is right out of that book. You know, you reach a point in time where people are sick of the corruption and sick of the stealing and theft and lying, anger over mistakes we made. That's how they phrased it in the book. Will catalyze a new movement. Has that happened? I would say absolutely it has. Will it change America? Absolutely, I think it will. Will it change world history? Absolutely, I think it will. The far left New World Order guys that happen to have more power in Europe than they do over here, I think they're on the chopping block, and I think you're going to see it. You saw it in Canada with the votes there. I think you're going to see it in portions of Europe. So I think that we're really revolutionizing what's taking place in the world right now, which is exactly what the fourth turning would tell you. Now, they said in there, countries have these very long lifespans, 80 to 100-year lifespans, where they go through these cataclysmic changes, like going from a caterpillar to a butterfly, metamorphosis. They said history does not predict the outcome of who's going to win that battle. Mm. But they said when you get into that situation, you're irrevocably in that change, and there's going to be a winner and a loser, and there's going to be probably, I still think that the potential for World War III is very real between now and, let's say, 2035-ish. I don't think most of these guys are going to mess with Trump, frankly. I don't think the next 4 years is likely, although Iran is a black swan. Now, last week we talked with Matt Gaertken. If you have not heard that interview yet, please go back. Please listen to it. If you heard it, I would listen to it again.
Yeah, it's very good.
I remember when we were talking about, you know, he's written a special report, Five Black Swans for 2025.
And they said, if you reach out to us, we're allowed to send that to you.
Ah, that's good. So you can get the special report. Anyway, so these are things that he thinks won't happen. And one of the things he said won't happen, and I had to read this twice. I did a double take. I'm like, okay, blah, 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 blah. What won't happen? And then what won't happen is we won't not have a major disruption in the Middle East. So he's putting a 75% probability that Israel will decide it's going to take out Iran and their nuclear facilities. That is massive. I've never heard him say anything remotely close to those odds. He backs it up with facts. It's all factual. It's not emotional hype. It's not some gold salesman. By the way, we're doing a special report on gold in this month's newsletter. I'm going to try it. Part of my goal is to start writing once a month at very least. I used to do that, I think, for 19 years. I never missed a monthly newsletter. And then a lot of life happened and a lot of disruptions happened. Now I need to get back to that because that helps. It helps our clients keep track of what we're doing. It helps everybody else understand. So what we're doing, we're changing formats here. I'm the chairman of the board now, not the president, so I'm not doing the day-to-day stuff at the company that much anymore. But what I am doing is setting the course, the sails. The captain has to make sure the ship's going the right way. I'm still that point. And so the issue is we're doing more interviews now than we've ever done, and that's probably going to continue. We've gotten good feedback on these. These are people, you're never going to hear them on even Fox News. They will be unknowns. But these are people that in the institutional research world are heavyweights. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to see them on the news media. When our good friend John Criswell used to be here, Of course, he was an ABC news anchor for the White House back in the 60s, and a local news anchor, many of you probably remember him, Wednesday's Child and all that stuff.
Most people remember.
The late John Criswell, and I'd ask him this, how can the media be so wrong all the time? And they have a certain agenda. He says, Jerry, they're under such tight schedules, they don't have time to do any deep research, even if they knew how to interpret it. You know, they're not trained on the stuff that you know. They're not trained on, and I'm not an expert in geopolitics, but I recognize one when I hear one or see one. They're not. They don't know the macroeconomics. They don't know anything about the markets. They just, oh, well, I've got an interview, and I've got a tight schedule, and I'll go pull somebody. In the old days, you had the Rolodexes with the list. Okay, right. Here's my favorite guest to ask. You know, I ask him this question on that. And they don't, but I interviewed a guy, Harry Dent, who discredited himself with one of his bad predictions, but his first book was incredibly accurate. It's probably as accurate as The Fourth Turning, one of the most accurate books I've ever seen. And so we interviewed him on that, and he said, your questions are very informed and very deep. Even the Alpine Macro guy said that. He said, your questions are tough. You ask tough questions. And what Harry said, we said, well, I do media interviews all the time. And he said, basically, the understanding of the people doing the interview with me is about a quarter of an inch thick. Yours is deep, and you take us real deep into what those things that people need to understand are, and that's fairly unique in this marketplace. So anyway, bottom line, we'll be doing more of that. We're expanding through podcasts. We decided not to do traditional radio syndication like we used to in the old days because we were on 37 stations or 35 at one point. Around the country, I think we've decided we're the new phase, which is the podcast, as opposed to traditional syndication with radio. And that doesn't mean we won't expand on radio. That just means that the next wave is clearly podcasts. That's how people listen. So the goal is this year, podcasts are starting. Special reports, I'm hoping every single month. I want to get back to being able to do this every single month and freeing up other time. My wife's still having some major health problems. If you believe in prayer, put her on your list. She just had cataract surgery, which is a good thing, but they wouldn't touch her because of her blood pressure before now. We found a specialist that's really good at that. So bottom line is she's still in recovery mode, but she's got a long road ahead of her. So more from me, but more from me through podcasting, more of me from new special reports, and we're going to be doing a lot more interviews of the experts that we've accumulated on. Wait a minute, I've read this guy for 10 years or whatever. He's extremely accurate. I'm going to put him on the show, not some guy off the Rolodex list just because they're easy to get to. So bottom line is you're going to, I believe, hear in-depth interviews like you're never going to hear anywhere else that I'm aware of. And again, the background, having the background of having studied under one of the disciples of Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize winner, revolutionized economics with his PBS did an entire series globally. They took him all over the world for his book, Free to Choose. And it's funny that PBS did it because PBS is left-wing-ish, and he's not. He's right-wing, totally. And without him, Margaret Thatcher probably doesn't happen. Ronald Reagan probably doesn't happen. The whole Reagan revolution, the Republicans shifting the way they are, the linchpin of that entire movement was Milton Friedman. He's not just a Nobel Prize-winning economist. In my opinion, he's the most important one in the last 100 years. And I studied as an undergraduate under one of his disciples, who was the leading forecaster, Dr. Richard Wilson, out at UT Arlington, one of the leading inflation forecasters in the country at the time. And so the macroeconomics, just as soon as I started into that field, I'm like, wow, this is the most fascinating thing I've ever studied. I can't get enough of it. And of course, here now I do it on the radio. So bottom line is we're going to be bringing more experts that you essentially are not going to be able to have access to from anywhere else that I'm aware of. And again, most of the radio talk show hosts, most of the podcast hosts, I've watched a bunch of them, you know, Joe Rogan, you name it. Lance Wallnau's good in a lot of areas. But again, I'm not trying to toot my own horn here, but the bottom line is they don't have the kind of background that I have in the macroeconomic world, writing a newsletter for, well, since 1981. Doing radio since 1980. So it gives us a kind of a unique edge, if you want to call it that, in the media world, which at some point I think will be recognized by other people besides us. But the bottom line is we've got a great interview coming up with Matt Gerken in just a moment. He's going to continue the interview, and he's going to talk about what's up to date with Russia and Ukraine. And what else is he talking about today's show, Michael?
China.
China.
And then you ask him specifically about the South China Sea.
Even, and I'm not predicting this and certainly don't want to be a doom and gloomer, but President Trump even outright said this. I saw it on Facebook. Believe it or not, I do Facebook now. He said, World War III is a distinct possibility, and, you know, there's stuff cooking there. So Matt's comment about Israel and Iran last week, we talked to him. He said it's, and this is not from a sensationalist or somebody that sells gold or any of that, you know, it's not the hype exaggeration. He said 75% probability that Israel will try to take Iran out in 2025. And Trump will try to negotiate a peaceful settlement initially, but he said he doesn't believe Israel will be deterred. They are so adamant that they will never let this happen to them again, and they know where it's coming from. So they're going to try to cut off the head of the snake, he believes. Now, will that create a wild ride in the market if it happens? Absolutely. He gives it 75% probability. He said you can't give 100% probability on anything in geopolitics. What we want to do now is go to the interview that he, the second half of the interview, which deals with China, with Russia. And China, in the long run, is really the issue. If you look at where we're headed in the next 10 or 15 years, China is the big dog that could be a rival to the United States. That's how they view the world. They want to be dominant in their sphere. They're not trying to take the whole world over like Hitler would have liked to do. They want to be the absolute dominant power in their sphere and recognized globally. But at the same time, the FBI uncovered, I think maybe it's CIA, that Xi Jinping had given an order to get ready to invade Taiwan by 2027, if I remember correctly. And it doesn't mean it's necessarily going to happen, but he told them militarily be prepared for that. That's fireworks on an international scale. Let's go ahead and do the interview with Matt Durkin.
Russia, Ukraine, you want to give us kind of an update on how you see that conflict playing right now?
Yeah, and it's moving very quickly over there right now because the U.S. Has sent its chief negotiator, Keith Kellogg, over to Europe, as well as the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth. So the talks are already happening. The Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has suggested that he's willing to negotiate with President Trump about, you know, some benefits that the Americans can get for helping Ukraine. He's willing to trade territory with Vladimir Putin. Of course, that is the reason why Ukraine invaded the Kursk area of Russia, was so that they would have some territory that they could try to trade off. Although, to be clear, it's about 1/6 of the territory that Russia holds. So it's nowhere near an equal trade-off. What's happening is the two armies are having trouble moving the battle lines substantially. Russia's sort of continually nibbling away, but Russia is running huge risks with its long-term social and economic stability by continuing this war. So just think about the Vietnam War, how the United States spent trillions of dollars and killed 60, 70,000 boys to wage this war. And it ended up over many decades leading to, it was one of the biggest factors leading to political polarization and partisanship being so out of control in the United States. And some of those were unintended consequences. Others were sort of direct consequences of the conflict. Wars are divisive by nature, especially gratuitous wars or wars of choice, I should say. This was a war of choice. Russia wanted to prevent, they needed to prevent Ukraine from joining NATO, but they still had some diplomatic options to make that happen because there were NATO members that were willing to veto Ukraine joining NATO. And they decided, well, they thought that the diplomacy was a dead end. So maybe they made a rash decision, or maybe Vladimir Putin was just forward looking. Either way, they've now run these very large costs. So Ukraine is witnessing the Americans clearly are going to pull support. And voters elected Republicans because they were saying, look, inflation was too high and we need to cut some federal spending. And one of the areas that voters agree on needs to be cut is foreign aid, economic and military aid abroad. So there is a mandate to cut this. And President Trump is saying, well, we'll negotiate a peace treaty and then we can reduce this spending on Ukraine. That makes a ceasefire virtually a done deal. If the Americans pull back the funding, then Europe is not going to pick up the funding to keep Ukraine fighting. So that's why Zelensky is saying he's willing to negotiate.
Okay.
Europe is clearly willing to negotiate. They also are facing domestic pushback over inflation and spending for the war. The key player now is Russia, because if Russia is thinking about the long term and they're thinking about the health and stability of their economy and their households, then they will actually embrace a ceasefire, and it'll be drawn along the current line of control in the region. And it'll basically be a North South Korea type situation where you do not have a peace treaty. You do not give any territory, not you don't give much territory back, but you do have a decision to stop shooting each other. But if Putin, if he's too prideful and he doesn't embrace this olive branch, then he could push further, seeing that the Ukrainians don't have much support. And that would then force President Trump to in Europe to go back and huddle and decide, okay, we're going to come back with even greater support for Ukraine. That would launch an entirely new phase in the war. You know, Russia's interest rates are up to 21 or 22%. They're struggling with inflation. They don't get investment from the outside world anymore, not from the West. It's very difficult for them. And I think that Putin will take hold of the ceasefire opportunity. The question is the timing. Some of these things are hard to negotiate. In my sense, it could actually happen within the year. I think it's moving pretty quickly. And so in my outlook, I sort of said, well, we're going to see a decline in geopolitical risk around Ukraine and Eastern Europe, but we'll be out of the frying pan into the fire because this is heating up over in the Middle East. But if I'm wrong, what you'll see is that the negotiations will extend further into 2026, maybe even 2027. My bet is that really now that the writing is on the wall, Ukraine doesn't have many options and Russia needs to start looking after its own social stability. And so we'll see a ceasefire within the year or two.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I know I asked you this when you were in studio some months ago. You and I are both familiar, very familiar with a book called The Fourth Turning. Okay, let's assume that you're right and there is a ceasefire negotiation and territories remain about where they are now. What does that say for the long term, though? If you look at further out, was this just a one-off that Putin had? Okay, I'm going to take some of the turf back that we lost, kind of thinking, and make us proud of our country again? Or is there more of a strategic, no, this is the beginning of a move that's going to lead to another move like a chessboard for Russia specifically?
Yeah, good. Right, good question. The driving factor here is that Russia, since the 1970s, has been in decay as a country.
Right.
And the Soviet Union collapsed, and then they lost a lot of territories that they controlled. And Putin represented this attempt to rebuild or reconstitute at least a few critical parts of that empire. And Ukraine, of course, used to be the core of Russia, and so it's the most critical. And Russian leaders are always willing to fight in Ukraine if they think a Western army is going to be permanently entrenched in Ukraine. And so on that basis, that's why Putin was willing to go to war in Ukraine. The problem is about the resources. Russia just has a shrinking population and extremely weak productivity, and it's weaker productivity now because, as I mentioned, Germany and Europe are no longer going to be investing in Russia very much. They're just a declining state, and the takeaway for all of us who are watching is that as this, it's a, you know, wounded and old, shaggy, dying sort of bear, but still extremely powerful. And
right.
the reactions are negative. It's like because Russia is decaying on the inside, they're striking out against others. And that's where you see them invade Georgia, Ukraine, and threaten the Baltic states. They don't have the capacity to wage a long-term war with NATO. Just draw up NATO's combined GDP versus Russia's, or NATO's combined military spending versus Russia's, or NATO's combined manpower versus Russia's. They have nuclear blackmail. That's a very important weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the ability to manipulate oil output. Although even there, if they cut off their oil output, they damage their own oil production over the long run. What I'm underscoring is that this was pretty specific to Ukraine. This was Russia saying, no, Ukraine doesn't get to join NATO. This was NATO kind of accepting, okay, Ukraine doesn't get to join NATO. And then a few other neutral powers, Finland and Sweden, saying, okay, well, if Russia is going to be invading people, we want to be part of NATO. And that was it. That was the episode here. Now what happens is Russia, there's two key issues. One is in the coming 5, 10, 15 years, eventually Putin will go one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Will the new leadership continue to pursue foreign aggression? As a, you've got domestic instability, do they continue to project that outward and be aggressive? That could lead to some really irrational and dangerous threats. Otherwise, they will have a more managed process where they combine with China and they play the junior partner in a Chinese alliance, which is basically bent at creating an alternative world system to the U.S. system. And it'll be rooted in Eurasia. It'll be rooted in Central Asia, Russia, China, parts of South Asia and the Middle East. It won't be hinging on necessarily invading anyone because they'll lack the capability. So those are the sort of two outcomes. The one that's most dangerous for global stability is one where they continue to be aggressive, because if they're aggressive in Georgia, Ukraine, well, that doesn't trip the NATO self-defense clause. But if they're aggressive toward Lithuania or Finland or in the Baltic Sea, they can trip the collective defense of NATO, and then we end up with a larger conflict.
All right. May you live in interesting times, the old Chinese proverb. Speaking of which, since the, again, we've read, both of us read the Fourth Turning book, and I don't want to overemphasize it, but I don't want to ignore it either. I want to bring up China next. So you're talking about Russia may, you know, maybe they'll back off, maybe they won't. But the bottom line is the world to me, I mean, I look at a lot of unstable players. I look at Iran, I look at North Korea, and China in particular is talking, you know, as you know, because you pointed it out, I read your materials, and I know it was other people that backed it up, that apparently we were told that China could invade and take over Taiwan as early as 27 or 28, 2027, 2028. It looks like a new axis of evil might be basically created here. Speak to a little bit about what you see China doing. I know right now their real estate market is just a bubble that popped, and it was it's still enormous, and it's still not played out. It's still not through their system yet. They've had a once in a generation, once in a century movement to industrialize from the farms to the cities. And I don't like the power structure over there, clearly. So tell me a little bit about what your view of China is, both short and long term.
The first thing to recognize is that the Communist Party never gave up state control. And under Xi Jinping, they have really consolidated that control. And what that means is that the Communist Party is in charge of the state bureaucracy, the central government. The central government in Beijing is in charge of the provinces and clawing back power from the provinces. And the core of China, you know, the kind of Beijing, Shanghai core of China is in charge of all the other regions. So that they, we saw over the past 15 years, 20 years, they have cracked down on Tibet and Xinjiang, and they removed Hong Kong's special rights and privileges that were born down from British colonial rule. So this is a consolidating empire. It's a sort of dynasty under the Communist Party. The belief is that the Western democracies are constantly erratic and changing their minds, incapable of formulating long-term policy. And so when the West comes to China and says, well, you really need to help us rebalance global trade for the sake of global stability, meaning that you should open up your markets so that we can export to your consumers. Your consumers can gain purchasing power through different reforms and import more Western goods and services. And then we can balance out our trade relationship. And then there's not going to be so much fear and distrust and hostility about a wealthier and more powerful China. Well, the problem with that is that the Communist Party would need to transfer wealth and assets to the household sector. Right now in China, a great deal of assets are held by state-owned enterprises, state-controlled banks, local governments in their vehicles, as well as even the military has a large role in the economy, has ownership of land and other assets. So you'd have to privatize these things, and that would then allow households to operate them, take these assets, operate them commercially to make money and get a good return. A new group of entrepreneurs, and eventually they would become elites because they would make a lot of money. And the Communist Party is sort of worried about this. On the one hand, it would be good. The households would be wealthier. You'd have a freer market. You'd be generating more growth. But on the other hand, you'd have this new rich faction that would think that it has its own prerogatives. It would say, oh, you know, we need to have a say in how we are taxed, or we need to have a say in how government spending is done, or we need to have a say in foreign policy or social policy. And that would effectively look like a democracy. That pressure, that public and social pressure from the households, is something that the Communist Party just refuses to allow. And so what you end up with is an economic model that's built entirely around the state, and the state driving investment and overproducing goods, which are then exported abroad. So we saw this. All of this story is very familiar, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners have heard this before in terms of, you know, the investment and export-driven economic model of China. But even if you just look at the statistics in 2024, meaning that everything you've heard your whole life about China, just in the last year, the statistics show us that they fell back on exporting. Exports in the fourth quarter made up 40% of their growth, which is really incredible. They also have not empowered consumption. Consumption continues to be an extremely anemic part of the GDP equation. Household consumption is about 40% of GDP. It's extremely low compared to other countries. So they're overinvesting, overproducing, and overexporting. And it's generating these trade tensions with the outside world. And what's interesting in the West is that we point to Donald Trump and we say, oh, he's a nasty protectionist. But what you're witnessing is, in fact, the reaction in the West to China's refusal to reform and rebalance. Now, to be fair to China, the Americans are not really rebalancing either. It's not as if Americans are saving a lot more. You know, we overconsume. Maybe we need to come back and cut our federal budget, raise our interest rates, and save more, you know. But neither the U.S. nor China is willing to undertake structural change, and instead we're engaging in sort of a game of chicken. But China has the assurance under Xi Jinping that if they just barrel through with their current strategy, which is invest in research and development and high technology and export, move up the manufacturing value chain and export to the rest of the world, their view is that the democracies will come and go and they'll be chaotic and incoherent, and there won't be a calculated and unified response from the West, so that they'll basically get away with it. And in the end, China will have an even larger share of global manufacturing, and they'll have a more advanced manufacturing. And that advanced technological component can then also be shared with their military, which it is, under a principle of civil military fusion, in order to ensure that their military modernization program makes them more capable of defending themselves and expanding a sphere of influence in East Asia, pushing back American influence. So all of this is the big story. You know, this makes the Iran story that we talked about actually quite small in comparison. The Iran conflict is, you know, we've seen wars in the Middle East. We've seen conflicts in the Middle East, and they come and go, sort of a perennial aspect of the world we live in. But what's a true change is China emerging as a competitor to the U.S., the U.S. struggling to come up with a coherent and durable strategic response, and China refusing to make the economic adjustments that would be necessary to pacify the Americans and prevent further distrust and further armament, you know, in the direction of conflict.
That's all great analysis. It gives us a wonderful backdrop to the whole thing. But bottom line, what do you think is going to happen with Hong Kong? Rather with Taiwan.
Taiwan, exactly. Well, and that's the thing, is think about what Hong Kong taught Taiwanese people. Taiwanese people prefer to be liberal, democratic, capitalistic, part of the international society. They don't want to be ruled by Beijing and the Communist Party. That's the essence of Taiwan. That's why Taiwan exists, coming out of the civil war in China. And they look over, and in 2019, China reneges on an agreement made with Britain and under the eyes of all the world in the 1997, saying, well, Hong Kong is going to get to retain a lot of aspects of British Commonwealth law. And the common law is important for capitalism. It's important for investors to believe in an independent judiciary and the upholding of contracts and private property, free press to help patrol, the government and make accountability and transparency part of the system. All of these things were removed. And from Taiwan's point of view, it was the perfect example of how, if you allow the Communist Party to take hold and to take control on the promise that they will grant you an exemption and grant you exceptions, well, later what you'll find out is no, they're still the Communist Party and they're going to take your rights away. And
Yep.
that's, of course, that's true. And of course, it was naive for Britain and America and everyone to think that Hong Kong was going to be able to retain their rights. But anyway, it happened. So from Taiwan's perspective, there is no accommodation. I mean, they have to continue trading with China. It's too big a part of their economy to, and they ultimately, some of them ultimately believe it would be basically about 10% believe it would be great if someday they could reunite as Chinese. About 30 or 35% believe that they need to be an independent country. And that's actually the party that's in power right now. And the other 55 to 60% believe, well, we can just keep this status quo going forever. We should just never resolve the issue because it'll be too big of a conflict. As long as China and the United States maintain a balance of power and an understanding with each other, then that status quo probably can be prolonged. But what's rupturing the status quo today is all the things I talked about with China. Those things make the US nervous, and specifically they think the China is getting more aggressive around Taiwan, rattling sabers and using economic sanctions, and that's going to continue, even to the point of using some like hybrid or gray zone military tactics to pressure Taiwan. So that's going to be going as just an element of China expanding their sphere of influence. But then the Americans are worried about it because if we lose Taiwan, then we lose influence and credibility. We lose our security alliance with, or let's say the stability of our alliance with South Korea, Japan, the Philippines. All those countries start to think, oh gosh, the Americans aren't able to defend us, and therefore we had better accommodate ourselves to Chinese rule in some way. Now, of course, the Japanese will never do that. Instead, they'll get nuclear weapons, and then we'll have an even more dangerous brewing tensions in the region, and the Americans will have less influence over the whole affair. And I haven't even mentioned semiconductors, which are sort of the obvious example of how the US economy would be negatively impacted, hugely negatively impacted if a conflict erupted. What this tells us is that Taiwanese are not going to be the ones to trigger a war, knowing that they're at ground zero. The Trump administration, I don't want to read too much into Trump himself or his rhetoric. You could argue that he's been somewhat dovish, meaning not eager to have a conflict over Taiwan. But what I would say is that effectively, Trump is going to try to uphold the status quo. So then the question boils down to China. And will they continue to push for greater influence in ways that become unacceptable to Taiwan and the United States? And as their economy declines, will they go the Russian path where you have internal instability and you start projecting that outward in the form of aggression? If they do that, then we'll end up with a much more dangerous standoff and ultimately probably a conflict. But here's hoping that they really don't go in that Russian direction where they think, well, instead, what we should do is we should at least somewhat reform our economy and at least somewhat maintain our trade relationships with the US and Europe. And then that way we don't become a hermetic kingdom, like a hermit kingdom like North Korea, and we don't end up in a major conflict where we squander our wealth and our influence by trying to retake this fortified mountainous island.
So, best case scenario obviously is maintaining the status quo somewhat and hoping China does not get too aggressive. That sound right?
I think that's right. And from the American point of view, of course, you've got to actually try to do something about this to ensure. And the issue is that it's very sensitive. It's very tricky. You've got to provide enough deterrence that China knows that attacking Taiwan is just a fool's errand. But you cannot over deter. You cannot become provocative yourself in a way that convinces China that it is inevitable that the Americans will take advantage of them, because then they would have an incentive to go ahead and prevent that from happening. So I think the Trump administration's challenge is to calibrate the Taiwan policy. And every administration has had this problem, how to calibrate. It's becoming a bigger problem today because China's economy is failing and the US is applying economic pressure, tech controls, and tariffs. And that means we're headed toward a larger conflict. And so now managing that strategic part is more difficult because there's a lot less trust.
Last question. This excellent interview, Matt. South China Sea. I know that a lot has been made of the ships, Chinese Navy making a show of force around the South China Sea, which I guess geographically, I suppose that's kind of south of Japan. What do you make of that? Is that just we want to make sure that you don't try to bully us, or no, we're trying to take over this turf and this is our turf?
Yeah, it's more of the latter. And the Americans over time effectively created a sphere of influence in the Caribbean. And President Trump has now reminded everyone of this by saying, calling attention to the sacrifices that America made to build the Panama Canal and saying that we're going to take it back.
Okay.
And he's also done that by referring to Greenland, basically applying the Monroe Doctrine to Greenland and saying, why should Denmark rule Greenland? Now, these are parts of a negotiation that Trump is doing to get Panama to give the US some benefits and get Denmark to pay more for Greenland. That's understood. But what I'm saying is that powerful countries create spheres of influence. Now, when China started to emerge in the 1980s, 90s, 2000s, they're building a navy and they're looking at American strategy and British strategy in other countries saying, we need a sphere of influence. And in particular, we need greater control over the critical sea lines of communication that bring goods that are essential to our economy over the ocean. So they started to look to the South China Sea and say that they wanted to create a sphere of influence the way that the Americans did. And in 1898, when America wanted to assert a sphere of influence in the Caribbean, Spain was a joke. The Spanish Empire had been collapsing at that point for 300 years, or 250 years. But China is wanting to assert a sphere of influence today where the American Empire is not necessarily, if anything, the American Empire is sort of reasserting itself.
Right.
Now, what is the significance of it? One, it's just all the trade that takes place in the South China Sea. But the other is that, of course, these are the supply lines for Taiwan as well. And ultimately, I think we should think of the South China Sea really first, it's a sphere of influence in general for China's imports. And they ultimately want to gain control of the Strait of Malacca, where Singapore is. They want to have overwhelming influence all the way to Singapore. And they want to be able to express power into the Indian Ocean and the Persian Gulf, as well as into the Western Pacific. But a critical part of the South China Sea story is simply having the military ability to cut off Taiwan's supplies and to cut off Taiwan in the event that they have a conflict. So we should see those as connected. And the Americans are just asserting our right to sail through the South China Sea and our right to have independent relationships with the different parties. But we're also doing something else. We're also sort of trying to make sure that we maintain a good strategic position in case there's a fight. So we went to the Philippines under the Biden administration and we reformulated our defense agreements so that we could operate out of our bases in the Philippines. All of this is telling you that turf battles are reemerging, ancient turf battles. I do think, as a concluding remark here, we should recognize the very fact that countries are talking about territory and territorialism and taking territory. That should leave you uneasy as a investor. Now, and I appreciate, Jerry, that you said earlier, I'm not an alarmist. I don't come on to just hype geopolitical risks and make
Right.
everybody stuff their money under the mattress. That's not the point. But look at the gold price. And Jerry, you know this, and we've talked about it before. What is the gold price telling you about the status of global stability? It's saying, uh-oh, global instability is a recurring theme. It's a rising trend. And a big part of it is that when Russia starts to decide, I want this piece of territory, and they take it by force. When China decides, I want these territories, I'm going to take them by force. And when the Americans even start talking about it, if only just to tell everybody, well, hey, put Russia and China on notice that we can play that game too if they really want to do that, fine. But the point is that you're starting to enter into true geopolitical. This is why we say geopolitics. It has to do with geo, earth, territory. And now we're getting into disagreements that are actually a lot harder to resolve than just debating about shaving a few more points off of tariff levels
Right.
or orchestrating a few more swap lines between our central banks. So I think we should just be guarded about this. And I think for 2025, the key risk is the Middle East. But I think for the 4-year term of Trump, clearly China, Taiwan, that's going to be the big risk.
Wow. Excellent. Awesome interview. Great information you don't hear really. I subscribe to a lot of different people, but I don't get the information like I do from you. So I appreciate this a lot. You being with us, Matt. Awesome interview as usual. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Well, that means a lot to me. Thank you, Jerry.
All right, Jerry, before we get to your thoughts on this part of the interview with Matthew Gerken, I first want to remind people to learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services, about Jerry Tuma and myself. You can go to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. You can see Jerry's previous special reports. Here in a week or so, you'll be able to get his new special report. So it's definitely a place you want to bookmark. You can also listen to our previous broadcasts and interviews. We post those on our website. And we are available on podcasts via Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Audible. So it makes it a lot easier for you if you want to catch us while you're out for a walk or a run or anything. You can listen to us there. And for a free consultation, please call us at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. All right, Jerry, was very good interview with Matt Gerken. What were your thoughts from this part?
Well, we talked about, obviously he talked about on previous show last week, the odds that he thinks that Israel is going to try to take Iran out this year is 75%. And that shocked me. And again, I did a double take on that, which I've said on the radio. But this interview here we did today is really, in a way, the more important of the two. Because one of the things, I'm going to read a quote directly from the interview that we just did. I said, all of this is a really big story, but the story that we're talking about now about China makes the Iran story quite small in comparison. That's a pretty big deal. The Iran conflict, we've seen wars in the Middle East. We've seen conflicts in the Middle East. They come and they go. Now, that's not underestimating the impact it could have on the economy and the markets in the short run. If we have a big blow up in the Middle East, it's going to disrupt things radically for a period of time. But it probably will be over in a few months. I don't think it's a long-lasting, it's not a World War III potential. China, on the other hand, is a different magnitude, and that's what Matt said. He said, we've seen conflicts in the Middle East. They come and they go. Sort of a perennial aspect of the world that we live in. And I get that. This one would be a magnitude we haven't seen before if that happens. But at the same time, what's the bigger issue? And the bigger issue is China. He said, true change is that China is emerging as a true competitor to the United States, and the U.S. is actually struggling to come up from here, come up with a coherent, durable strategic response. China is refusing to make economic adjustments. He talks about Taiwan. The issue here really is this. We're in a historic period of time where we're dealing with a clash of titans, a clash of world empires. The United States has been dominant since the late 1800s in the world. You know, we rescued the world from two world wars, essentially, in Europe, and we're still the dominant economic power by far. You know, China is coming up, but we're still much stronger than them economically. They, again, have some, I wouldn't say slave labor anymore, but it's, you know, they've come out of that type of thing. But there's dictatorial absolute control over there. There's no freedom of speech, per se, or you might disappear in there. So you still have the communist aspect ruling it politically. But the issue is they've got the 1.3 billion people that we know about. They've got long-term issues with demographics and other stuff. We don't have time to get into all that today. But the bottom line is it looks to me like, and this is why we're recommending people read a book called The Fourth Turning, number four, Fourth Turning. It was written in the 1997 era, and it's truly proving out to be absolute about this. I'm not a great fan of Steve Bannon, but he's talked to Trump about this whole issue. And I think Trump's aware that we're in historic change times. So anyway, this interview with Matt Gerken, I think, was great. But the China conflict potential, that's what really jumps out at me. As the Chinese proverb said, may you live an interesting time.
All right. We'll talk to you all again next week.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services, an independent financial group, LLC, or unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.